second day in trial of a white former officer over the murder of George Floyd hears testimonies from people who witnessed the death of the black man.
I heard George Floyd say, "I can't breathe, please get off of me, I can't breathe."
Brazil registers a new daily record of nearly 3,800 COVID-19 deaths, which accounts for about a quarter of Tuesday's fatalities worldwide. Also in headlines this hour, Germany restricts the use of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine to people aged 60 and over after recording cases of a rare brain blood clot in people receiving the jab. Welcome. Our top story this hour, the second day in trial of a white former police officer over the murder of George Floyd hears testimonies from people who witnessed the death of the unarmed African American.
I heard George Floyd saying, "I can't breathe, please get off of me, I can't breathe." He cried for his mom. He was in pain. It seemed like he knew. Seemed like he knew it was over for him. He was terrified. He was suffering. This was a cry for help.
The 18-year-old Frazier, who did not appear on camera, apologized to George Floyd for not doing more, not physically interacting and trying to save his life. Frazier said she witnessed, quote, "a terrified and scared man begging for his life." On the other hand, lawyers for Derek Chauvin argued that he followed his police training and was not guilty of the charges. During an arrest last May, Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck in that fashion you see in that picture there for more than 8 minutes before he lost consciousness and died. The incident, filmed by bystanders, rocked the United States and led to widespread protests against police mistreatment of African Americans. Our correspondent, Colin Campbell, says George Floyd's murder trial is a big case for all African Americans in the U.S.
Well, this really could be defined as, so far, the trial of the century. I know we don't have many big ones so far, but this one will stand for years to come. And that's because there's a lot at stake in this trial. When you look at the amount of evidence and the video evidence that was shown and what happened, the death of George Floyd, and of course the ramifications that have followed throughout 2020, we can really see that for particularly black Americans, black men, this is very much a big case. And so what we heard from today was the guy who practiced MMA, who was on the scene, who talked about his experience in understanding different chokeholds and pressure points when trying to subdue an opponent, and how they were similar into what the police officer Derek Chauvin was using on George Floyd for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And the other day I talked about that number, 9 minutes and 29 seconds. We had been saying 8 minutes and 46 seconds. If you remember, even in some of the protests and the chants, people talked about 8 minutes and 46 seconds was the amount of time that Chauvin had his knee on the back of George Floyd. But we know that it was actually a bit longer than that, almost 9 minutes and 30 seconds.
Brazil sets a new record in its coronavirus fatalities as the pandemic shows no sign of abating in the Latin American country. Brazil registered nearly 3,800 daily COVID-19 deaths and almost 85,000 new infections. The government has come under fire for its handling of the crisis. Vaccination has also been sluggish there, with fewer than 7% of people having received a jab. Brazil is the second worst-hit country by the pandemic after the U.S. Fatalities in the U.S. have surpassed 550,000 and infections stand at over 30.3 million. Chancellor Angela Merkel says Germany has restricted the use of AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine to people age 60 and over, as well as high priority groups. Merkel also noted that she is open to being vaccinated with AstraZeneca's jab. Health officials earlier said under 60s can decide to take the vaccine, but only following consultation with the doctors carrying out the vaccination and with an individual risk analysis. The decision came after the country recorded 31 cases of a rare brain blood clot in people receiving the jab. In 9 cases, the affected people lost their lives. More than a dozen European countries had halted their use of the vaccine. Some nations have, however, resumed vaccinations following assurances from the World Health Organization. Our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, says the issues caused by the AstraZeneca vaccine is a blow to Europe's vaccination policy.
We did have it reaffirmed from the World Health Organization and the European Medicines Agency and individual health agencies across the 27 nations EU that it was safe to use, that the benefits outweigh the risks, as you say. But I suppose as more and more people and millions more people take the vaccine, then I suppose it opens up the issue of statistics. It is a relatively small number compared to the number of people who have taken the vaccine. The problem is AstraZeneca is such a key player in the European Union, and it will be certainly over the next few weeks, because we have the batches that are due to arrive before the end of this month. Wednesday tomorrow is the end of the month. But even so, millions are due to take the AstraZeneca vaccine. And the big question is, you know, we've already had major problems with the rollout here in the EU. Will people be hesitant to take the vaccine? Will they be afraid to take the vaccine? So it's another blow to the EU's already shambolic vaccination strategy, you could say, the rollout strategy.
Turkey has announced tighter measures against the coronavirus, citing the rising number of high-risk cities across the country. The Turkish government is also planning to shut down restaurants during the holy month of Ramadan. Rashan Saglam is in Istanbul.
Following a late cabinet meeting on Monday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced his government's decision to reinstate a total lockdown on weekends in most Turkish states. The decision came after the number of daily infections with coronavirus reached more than 30,000. Erdogan also stated that during the holy month of Ramadan, the weekend lockdown and daily curfew from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. will continue, with restaurants only serving delivery and takeouts.
During the month of Ramadan, restaurants and cafes in Turkey will only be allowed to deliver food as part of the measures against the COVID-19 pandemic, as weekend curfews will again be in place on Saturdays.
A week ago, Turkish president had refused to tighten restrictions. He said, although the number of daily infections is high, the number of those hospitalized is less. Some criticize what they call the government's double standards in dealing with the situation, as it is preventing wedding parties and home visits, while the ruling party is organizing conferences to promote for 2023 elections.
Of course, infection rates will continue to rise due to the majority not abiding by the instructions. For example, when the government eased restrictions on restaurants and cafes and were all allowed to operate without preventive frameworks, people and restaurants themselves did not abide by the measures. However, you cannot ask people to be careful and follow restriction guidance when you hold popular gatherings to promote your party for the elections. This contradicts your own statements and measures. On the one hand, they stress the need to adhere to social distancing and the use of protective masks, and on the other, they organize public conferences with public attendance.
Turkish president said that 80% of Turkey's citizens live in high-risk provinces, including the capital Ankara and the biggest city in the country, Istanbul. The government now hopes that by the end of the holy month of Ramadan, the majority of Turkish citizens and residents would be vaccinated so that Turkey can welcome tourists again. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
A report has found that an increasing number of Italians are struggling to cope with the financial impact of the COVID-19. Many are struggling even to pay their rent. Max Civili has a report from Rome.
A new report on household debt by the Bank of Italy has highlighted that some 40% of Italian households are struggling to pay the rent amid economic difficulties linked to the effects of the coronavirus pandemic. According to the report, a large number of indebted families, 3 out of 10, and individuals, 4 out of 10, have said they are having trouble keeping up the payment of their rents or mortgage installments.
The work situation has worsened significantly, particularly for those who had a casual part-time job. For many, it's hard even to make ends meet. Bear in mind that pupils were forced to follow their classes online up to last week, and also for this reason, families have been under huge pressure.
Besides the economic impact of COVID restrictions, there are increasing concerns regarding the obvious effects on people's mental health. Many simply cannot see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Not long ago, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, warned that some 5.6 million people were recorded as living in absolute poverty in Italy in 2020, an increase of about 1 million over the previous year. About 300,000 small and mid-sized firms that are especially vulnerable to the business disruptions inflicted by the pandemic have gone bankrupt.
Italy was in dire financial straits before the COVID-19 pandemic struck. It was the only G7 country not to have seen its economic growth return to pre-2007 levels after the global financial crisis, and its per capita income is the same as 23 years ago.
The health minister said all non-essential shops will stay closed for the entire month of April, even if the situation rolls back to normal. We disagreed with this approach. Shop must reopen. Italian must get back to work.
Meanwhile, a solidarity initiative to support poor families hit by the pandemic has been officially launched by the National Farmers Association Coldiretti. At least 20,000 households struggling in the middle of the pandemic will be receiving high-quality food products to ensure good meals during Easter festivities. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have marked the 45th anniversary of Land Day. The occasion marks the death of six Palestinians at the hands of Israeli forces during mass protests in 1976. Ruba Shabit reports.
Along with a series of events held by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip to mark the Land Day, Palestinian students and youth community also organized a conference. Students, residents, activists, and resistance leaders attended the conference, which was held in connection with several countries around the world to support the Palestinian cause.
We are marking the 45th anniversary of the Land Day, while about 25 countries around the world are participating to voice their support for Palestinian cause. We are stressing on our right of return to our lands and that Jerusalem al-Quds will remain the capital of Palestine. People who marked Land Day proved they will keep fighting the Israeli occupation to gain their rights.
On the eastern parts of the enclave, near the separation fence, Palestinians also held an event stressing on their right of return to the occupied lands. They also expressed their refusal for the recent normalization of ties with Israel and considered it as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
We stress that Israeli occupiers will leave our land by force, and Palestinian resistance won't remain silent against Israeli violations of Palestinian land and rights. We call on the world to stop the normalization of ties with Israel. That gives Israel a green light to keep up its inhuman aggression and crimes against Palestinians.
We are proving that we won't give up defending our land. What happened on this day is unforgettable, and we stress that we won't allow Israel to take over our Palestinian lands. We mark this day to express that the resistance is our way to defend Palestine and force the Israeli occupation to leave.
Land Day is marked every year by Palestinians since March 30, 1976, to honor those who fell while defending their lands from being illegally seized by the Israeli government, when Israel declared its intention to annex approximately 5,000 acres of land from its Palestinian owners in several villages. The Land Day comes as Palestinians are calling the international community to stop the Israeli expansionism and land grab, vowing they will keep fighting until liberating Palestine and its capital, Jerusalem al-Quds. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The UN says an airstrike carried out by France earlier this year killed at least 19 civilians in Mali. In a report, the UN mission in Mali said about 100 people were attending a wedding party when the bombing took place. It said at least 22 people died in the strike, only three of them militants. The incident occurred on January the 3rd when French warplanes pounded an area near the remote village of Bounty. Residents of the village said the strike hit a wedding party, but the French military rejected the reports and said it had killed only militants. France still denies targeting civilians and has rejected the report of the UN mission. Now, the French government has concluded its inquiry into Paris's role in the Rwandan genocide of 1994. An official report shows the government was responsible, but not an accomplice. Our correspondent in Paris, Kristen Hunt, has an update.
France is responsible but not complicit in the Rwandan genocide. That's the main conclusion of a report on the Rwandan genocide that the official Duclair Commission submitted to French President Emmanuel Macron. In 1994, extremist militia from Rwanda's Hutu ethnic group slaughtered more than 800,000 people from their own ethnic group as well as the Tutsis minority in a matter of 3 months. France intervened before, during and after the genocide, but not to prevent it. François Granet, who is the author of The French State and the Genocide of the Tutsi in Rwanda, says the French government's report into the issue does not go far enough.
From 1990
to 1995, French decision makers decided to maintain Rwanda in their zone of influence. They decided to arm the regime and to support the Hutus extremists against Tutsi before, during, and even after the genocide. The French authorities had been perfectly informed on the issue. Even if France did not have any intention to commit genocide, the French support had an undeniable facilitating effect on the Hutus extremists.
Experts have proof that French authorities received many alerts during the ongoing genocide. In this video shot in Rwanda during the genocide, a French sergeant warns the French Army's chief of special operations that Tutsis are being massacred not far from where they are. But the French colonel does not react.
Complicity means help, and France allows the creation of an extremist government and its recognition by the international community. The perpetrators of genocide are welcome in France, and they find shelter in France and in Belgium once the genocide is completed. France delivers weapons before, during, and after the genocide. All this means political complicity.
Rwanda is a small country, mostly agricultural, with very few natural resources. No big deal. So why this was of interest to France?
France gives the support to dictators. If one goes down, the others will not trust France anymore. In the beginning of France Africa in the 60s, France abandoned one dictator and the consequences were catastrophic. Mitterrand and other French presidents swore not to abandon any other African dictator.
The report on Paris's role in the Rwandan genocide has other downsides besides trying to obscure France's real role. The probe was carried out with Parliament, where Macron's allies have a majority, refusing to give investigators full access to relevant archives. This new report highlights the responsibility of France in the genocide in Rwanda. However, this National Assembly refused to open all the archives, and French authorities still do not want to admit their complicity in the genocide. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Egypt warns that Ethiopia's enormous dam project on the Nile risks, quote, unimaginable instability in the region. The news conference president Abdel Fattah al-Sisi described Egypt's share of the Nile's waters as a red line, while upstream Ethiopia says the dam is vital to the energy needs of its people. Downstream Egypt says it is an existential threat. Sudan, which is also downstream, fears the Grand Ethiopian Resistance Dam will compromise its own share of water resources. The dispute over Ethiopia's construction has been simmering for around a decade, and mediation attempts have repeatedly failed. Last July, Addis Ababa announced it had completed the first steps of the embankment and would proceed with the second stage, with or without an accord. Well, that's it for me.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As China's capabilities match and inevitably surpass those of the U.S. military, Washington will find itself pushed out of the Indo-Pacific region, and its status as the world's so-called superpower will have been erased. We now present you an article written by Brandon J. Weichert, the author of Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower. The piece is titled America Losing the Future to China. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Brandon J. Weichert's article. Few Americans realize it, but their country's dominance in high technology innovation is now in question. This is something that Google's former chief executive officer, Eric Schmidt, acknowledged in his recent testimony before U.S. Congress. Meanwhile, Elon Musk, a business magnate, industrial designer, and engineer, has stated that China will become the world's premier economy and world power, in large part because of Beijing's consistent investment in high-technology innovation. Whether it be artificial intelligence or space technology, China is rapidly becoming a dominant player in high-technology development. As these trends intensify over the next decade, China's military superiority over the United States will naturally increase as well. For example, at the end of February, China surprised Western intelligence services with the sudden launch of a trio of Yuagan 331 satellites. As U.S. Senator Gary Peters, a Democratic member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, noted, this was the third launch since 31st of January, a clear indication that China's capabilities are rapidly catching up with those of the United States. As China's capabilities match and inevitably surpass those of the U.S. military, Washington will find itself pushed out of the Indo-Pacific region, and its status as the world's so-called superpower will have been erased. The Yaogan constellation was inaugurated in 2006 with the launch of China's first synthetic aperture radar satellite for constant all-weather imaging of the Earth. Just a year later, the constellation's first optical satellite was deployed. By 2009, the first trio of Yaogan electronic reconnaissance satellites were added to the growing constellation. Most experts believe that the Yaogan satellite constellation is akin to the U.S. Naval Ocean Surveillance System. These satellites intercept radio signals from the ground and use them to triangulate and track the position of warships at sea. This is an essential evolution in China's growing naval and space capabilities. Yaogan will allow China's rapidly modernizing military to monitor increasingly vulnerable American military units operating near China. The key strategic aim for China is to deter U.S. military intervention into the Indo-Pacific. The Yaogan satellite constellation's ability to track and target U.S. naval assets is essential for China's growing anti-access area denial strategy. In fact, Beijing has taken extraordinary steps to protect the Yaogan constellation itself from American anti-satellite attack. In 2018, for example, a small co-orbital satellite was deployed alongside one of the surveillance satellites of the Yaogan constellation. No one knows what the co-orbital satellite's mission was. My colleague, Brian Cho, has nicknamed these co-orbital satellites space stalkers. In peacetime, these tiny and maneuverable systems can be used to repair larger satellites remotely. However, in wartime, they can be fashioned into devastating space weapons. Space stalkers could serve as bodyguards for sensitive satellites like those in the Yaogan constellation. These bodyguards could deflect American anti-satellite attack against satellites belonging to the Yaogan constellation. This would keep the Yaogan constellation operating in a war with the United States, increasing China's military superiority over the U.S. military forces in the Indo-Pacific region. Many American strategists believe that as China becomes more reliant on satellites over the next decade, the U.S. armed forces will be able to hold China hostage by threatening these vulnerable satellite constellations. Yet the presence of space stalkers among sensitive Chinese satellite constellations indicates an added layer of protection that American systems otherwise lack. Therefore, deterrence will be difficult to impose from Washington. And China will still possess an asymmetrical advantage. China needs systems like the Yaogan satellite constellation to keep the U.S. military just over the horizon in the Indo-Pacific. The harder it is for the United States to deploy forces reliably to fight Chinese forces in the South or East China Seas, the greater the advantage Beijing enjoys over Washington. Yet China's growing military capabilities have only occurred because the United States prematurely surrendered in the race for high technology development. David P. Goldman outlines in his recent book, while the United States has grown complacent, Beijing has identified key strategic industries that they want China to capture. By capturing high-technology fields like those of quantum computing, space technology, biotechnology, or artificial intelligence, China will become the center of the world. Once China is a source of innovation for the new industrial revolution, its military will naturally grow in capabilities. Beijing could force fundamental changes to the international order that has long favored America. With each new development, China's strategic military superiority over the United States grows. Over time, as per Beijing's design, the balance of power will shift in China's favor, and that balance is unlikely to shift back to the United States, as China becomes the center of the new high-technology industrial revolution. America must create a long-term strategy for high-technology research and development before China leapfrogs the United States technologically over the next decade, not only becoming the world's largest economy, but eventually surpassing the U.S. military. If a federal research and development strategy is not developed and implemented soon, the United States will lose the future to China, just as both Eric Schmidt and David Goldman fear. As Donald Rumsfeld, the former U.S. Defense Secretary, once said, "We are on notice, but we have not noticed." Here's to hoping Washington notices soon.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Salaamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. How are you?
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you.
Brother Miqdad, one of our listeners has a question that she asked. My child is insisting that I buy him a laptop. I don't think it's the right time. But all his friends are involved in activities that require a laptop. Do you have any advice? So this is another question that usually parents have, where they feel that there's also a necessity of a laptop, but again, they feel that it's not the right time for them to buy a laptop for their children. So what do you advise?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So a laptop in today's world is something very common and something, I would say, necessary as well. It's difficult to live a life without a laptop. And fortunately or unfortunately, this need for a laptop starts quite early on in children, especially with the situation that we are in right now. You can't do without. So it's a natural request for a child to ask for a laptop.
Yeah.
A couple of things that I want to mention, and obviously there's a lot of things that we mentioned previously, all the general guidelines and advice about child upbringing as well, play a very important part over here. So the first one about laptop is, if it's possible, to make it something common, right? I'm quite against children having phones or laptops or gadgets that are specific to them, right? Where they can go into their room, close the door, and be involved in those at their own time, at their own desires, basically. Yeah. No, it should be something common. Mm-hmm. If you can get a desktop with a massive screen, even better, right? Yeah. In a way that and it's placed in the sitting room, in the living room, where it's common for everybody. It's not a child's, basically. It's a family laptop. It's a family computer. Mm-hmm. Even if it's primarily used by the child itself, right? Himself or herself. However, it's still named or called as a family laptop, as a family computer. And so the child doesn't feel that I own this. And this is, I feel, very helpful to eliminate all the influences that can have with it. It's in a common space, uh-huh. whether it's a living room or a common area where parents are passing by, brothers and sisters are passing mm-hmm. by. So it's the child, what he does or what she does on the laptop or on the computer screen is seen by everyone if wanted to be.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean that the parents should spy on the child and mm-hmm. constantly be there on sitting on his head trying to find out what he's doing. No, yeah. that's not the case. On the contrary, you should leave him to do what he wants to uh-huh. do. But the environment is such that it's in a common place mm-hmm. and you're less likely to get involved in mischief uh-huh. if it's on in a common place. And the fact that it's not counted as yours is also a big factor in uh-huh. in this as well.
So basically you're saying that, you know, the parents provide their children to use a laptop and they keep an eye on them.
Keep an eye on them in a sense that you, the moment you make it common is like keeping an eye on them. Uh-huh. I wouldn't suggest to stand by them the whole time. Uh-huh. Definitely not. Let them be independent. Let them find their own way through the computer, through the laptop, and do as they want. Obviously, to some extent, I'll mention in a second. However, because in a common place, it fulfills the goal that we want to achieve.
Thanks so much, Brother McDowell. And it's time for a short break. Dear audience, do not go anywhere. We'll be right back after a short break.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience, and we're discussing about parents buying a laptop for their children. And Brother McDowell has mentioned a few points. So, Brother McDowell, do you think that a desktop is better than providing children with a laptop?
In one sense, because it's in a fixed place, mm-hmm. You don't move it around. It's got more of a sense of a stability, and yeah. you can put a bigger screen to it, etc. It's got more value for sure. Mm-hmm. It feels more like something that you come to it
mm-hmm.
and you use it because yeah. you've got a purpose, and then you leave it and you move around and do other things.
Yeah.
A laptop is something you can carry wherever you want. Mm-hmm. You're more attached to it. Mm-hmm. It comes with other things that you don't want to bring to it, mm-hmm. basically. See, that this gadget, this laptop or the computer is actually a tool that you want to uh-huh. use, right? So you yeah. use the tool whenever you need to use it, yeah. and when you don't need to use it, you put the tool away,
mm-hmm.
right? Another point I'd like to mention is we need to make sure that a child, whilst not feeling sensitive about certain things,
mm-hmm.
is actually preventing certain things to happen. So the usage of internet should never be free,
uh-huh.
right? This is very,
very
important.
What do you mean by free, like being free?
I mean that it shouldn't be unlimited usage of internet whenever and however I want,
uh-huh.
right?
Yeah.
This is quite clear to all of us, I think, that mm-hmm. the internet is one of the primary sources of mischief,
yeah.
of learning things, of seeing things, of being aware of things that you don't want children to become
yeah.
Aware of or looking at. It can become a very filthy thing
mm-hmm.
And a very dangerous thing for children, not just from a sexual perspective, not just from a violent perspective, uh-huh. but also from an intellectual perspective as well, that it can be having brainwashing effects
mm-hmm.
At the faith level, at yeah. the intellectual level, basically, on what we learn and what kind of worldview we have.
Mm-hmm.
So there is definitely a need to control the usage of internet. Now, how do we do this? There's different ways. It can be a parental guide system. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It can be a clear instruction of what sites mm-hmm. to go and what sites not mm-hmm. to go. Yeah. Definitely use a bit of both, a bit of uh-huh. all the different techniques that you can have out there. Definitely censor anything that's over 18 sites.
Yeah.
Have strict control on the things that they go on. But at the same time, you don't create a sensitivity towards, you don't create curiosity towards it. It shouldn't be the case that you made it so explicit that they can't go on this site that it feels like, oh, I really want to find out what are those sites I'm not allowed to go into, right? So you don't create a kind of a curiosity towards that. But at the same time, you also allow a lot of freedom. So the things that the child is allowed to do, then allow good exploration, right? Allow the child to be free in exploring what they think. And also at the same time, it's very important to discuss what they explore, what they learn, what they're using. This is very important as well. We talked about this in animation as well. When we said that animation is very important, we can't escape it. Let's watch it. Let's allow it to happen, but discuss it. Talk about it. Let's have a family gathering. We talk about these things. Yeah. What do you watch today? What do you think about this? How was this portrayed?
Yeah.
This is very important. Same thing with computers as well. When they're exploring Wikipedia or on Google, they're researching different things. Let's talk about what they learned, how they perceived things. Mm-hmm. And through that, you can see what they're thinking and correct their thinking as well.
Thanks so much, brother. It's time for a short break, and your audience will be right back after that. Do not go anywhere.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. So, Brother Mughdad, if you don't mind, let me ask a question. Like, there might be a need for the laptop, like for doing the school projects or doing their homeworks. But also, it has got some drawbacks that the children might waste their time on like being on the laptop, like playing games and all. So how do we manage this, like the pros and the cons of having a laptop?
You balance it in a way that children should be allowed to play on the computer. Mm-hmm. You have computer games, as I said before as well. It's part of our lives these days that children play computer games. Obviously, you have a time restriction, half an hour a day, 45 minutes a day, depending how much TV time they have, depending on how much screen time they have, depending on what games they have. Obviously, we've chosen the right games, etc. But it's very normal for them to spend time on the computer. Giving them that space to explore things is fine as well, obviously in a controlled and balanced environment. One very essential thing that I like to mention over here is the attitude that we have towards laptop and computers and gadgets in general. Mm-hmm. This is something very important. We need to teach children the attitude that we have towards this gadget is the attitude of a tool, right? That you're using this as a tool.
Yeah.
Not that you're using it for wasting time or for leisure or for just because we've got nothing else to do, we just go on the thing. No, you make it very clear that you go sitting on a laptop because you've got a school project to do. You do the school project. Once it's finished, you switch it off, right? Yes. It's very important to have this kind of... It's not like... I know most of us like these days are like this, right? You've got a second, nothing happening for that 5 minutes. Then you pick up your phone and you just going through all your Facebook or your Instagram and just scrolling basically on and on. You want to remove this attitude. Use it as a tool. I need to contact somebody. I take my phone out. I contact this person. Then I switch off my phone and put it back in my pocket.
Yeah.
Using it as a tool is very important. Same thing when you're doing... a research project, you're writing up something, you teach a child that you're doing a research project, go on the laptop, go on the computer, do your research, spend as much as time as necessary, don't get distracted by other things out there. You're doing your research, finish it, once you're done, then you switch off the laptop basically, or the computer. So the attitude is very important to be able to handle this and to gain the skills of how to deal with these things. And lastly, it's very good because obviously in today's world, we're a world of technology and computers, to teach skills to children.
Like teaching different softwares, like how to use them, like different programs.
Exactly. So you can make the best out of it.
Yeah.
Since one side, we let the child to Google and Wikipedia and those kind of things. But I would say rather than that, direct the child towards learning programming, learning how to create and design an app, for example, or graphics, or video editing or animation and After Effects and these kind of things, and make child very talented in these things, right? And this is very, very good. The child, at the same time, you're using the computer. The child feels like, I'm using the computer like all my friends. But they're actually gaining a lot of new skills and they're actually becoming quite talented. This is very positive. It's more positive than them spending time playing or them spending time browsing the internet without any...
That's actually very beneficial, like if a child is learning different programs and all.
Definitely.
So thank you so much, Brother Miqdad, and thank you so much to your audience for staying with us. In this program, we discuss about the different consequences of children having a laptop. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until the next program, fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Montana Report notes that regardless of which president or party controlled the White House, the United States has never fully investigated the civilian cost of its operations in Yemen, has never taken sufficient steps to review the efficacy of these operations, and has never provided civilian victims the acknowledgement, apology, and reparations they are owed. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading Death Falling from the Sky. Report spotlights civilian harm from U.S. drone strikes in Yemen. Stay tuned for the details, please. A report published recently by Yemeni human rights defenders examines dozens of casualties resulting from U.S. drone strikes and other attacks on civilians in the war-torn nation in recent years. Incidents, the publication says, often occur without accountability, investigation, compensation, and sometimes even acknowledgement. The report entitled Death Falling from the Sky, Civilian Harm from the United States Use of Lethal Force in Yemen, was published by Matwana for Human Rights. It covers the dozens of U.S. military operations conducted between January 2017 and January 2019, a period during which then-President Donald Trump loosened the military's rules of engagement that were meant to protect civilians. At least 38 Yemeni civilians, including 13 children, 6 women and 19 men, were killed in these operations, the report notes. At least 7 civilians, including 6 children, 5 of whom were under the age of 10, and 1 man, were injured. Civilians were going about their everyday lives, driving to visit friends, bringing food to their families, sleeping in their homes, when killed or injured. These U.S. operations also caused other forms of deep and long-lasting civilian harm, it continues. The incidents led to adverse economic effects, killing primary breadwinners whose families relied on their incomes, and damaging and destroying important civilian property, including vehicles, homes, and livestock. The operations also caused significant social and psychological harm. In a few cases, surviving members of families left their homes following U.S. operations, saying they felt unsafe and worried about future strikes. The 12 U.S. attacks detailed in the report include 10 drone strikes and 2 ground raids in 5 Yemeni governorates, including Abyan al-Bayza, Shabwa, Hadhramaut, and Mareb. In only one case did U.S. officials acknowledge harming civilians. The report raises serious concerns about the extent to which the United States is complying with international law in its use of lethal force in Yemen. The United States is failing to investigate credible allegations of violations, to hold individuals responsible for violations accountable, and to provide prompt and adequate preparations, it states. The report also reveals details about communications between U.S. military officials. On January 25, 2017, for example, Marine Corps General Joseph Dunford Jr., then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, emailed General Joseph Votel, head of U.S. Center's Command, CENTCOM, to wish him good hunting. 4 days later, a U.S.-led air and ground attack targeting Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, fighters in Yakla area of Al-Bayza governorate, killed at least 15 civilians, including 10 children. Among these was Nawar al-Awlaki, an 8-year-old U.S. citizen who, according to her grandfather, was hit with a bullet in her neck and suffered for 2 hours. Nawar's father, Anwar al-Awlaki, a radical person, and her brother, Abdurrahman al-Awlaki, both American citizens, were also killed in separate U.S. drone strikes. Barzan Muhammad Abdullah al-Mabkut al-Amir, then 10 years old, was the only member of immediate family to survive the Yakla attack. "We were all asleep when we suddenly heard the shooting," he told the report's authors. "Our mother gathered us in one room to protect us. My grandfather was immediately killed after he left the house. The house collapsed, and my mother, father, and siblings were all killed." After denying that the raid killed any civilians, standard U.S. operating procedure, and calling the attack very successful despite the death of a Navy SEAL, American officials belatedly conceded that civilians, including children, were likely killed. CENTCOM, however, blamed AQAP for allegedly hiding women and children within militant operating areas and terrorist camps. The Matwana report notes that regardless of which president or party control the White House, the United States of America has never fully investigated the civilian cost of its operations in Yemen, has never taken sufficient steps to review the efficacy of these operations, and has never provided civilian victims the acknowledgement, apology, and reparations they are owed. To remedy this, the report recommends U.S. officials abide by all applicable international law requirements regarding the use of force in civilian areas, robustly investigate reports of civilian harm, acknowledge, apologize, and compensate when U.S. forces kill or injure civilians, and cooperate with the United Nations and other investigations. These steps, the report says, can go a long way towards disrupting cycles of violence. For years, the U.S. has contributed to fueling and feathering conflict in Yemen, it states. It is entirely possible to change course. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the nearly seven-year invasion of Yemen, widely recognized as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, has directly or indirectly claimed at least 233,000 lives. Other UN agencies warned last month that more than 2 million Yemeni children under the age of 5 would likely suffer acute malnutrition this year, and as many as 400,000 of them could die if not quickly given desperately needed treatment. A report published recently by the international charity Save the Children revealed that children made up around a quarter of the war's casualties in the years 2018 to 2020. If the Biden administration were to adopt the recommendations outlined in this report, it would constitute a significant step towards transforming the United States' relationship to Yemen, it concludes. In the end, the best approach the U.S. can take towards Yemen is beginning to listen, heed, and support the many Yemenis already working to build a country that centers rights aspect, respect, peace, and justice.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.